Prime Minister said very clearly in the election campaign that they were not going to leave anyone behind. And I'm going to take him at his word that that includes us, includes our community, and includes that changes can't leave any of us behind.
The government needs to do more to stop the flow of people with disability into group homes. And that requires some real energy and thought, you know, and some real kind of effort.
I think that we all need to have each other's back on the fact that on our right to be here and do this work as DROs. That has to be a not negotiable. So if we don't allow for fracturing or sidelining of anyone, then, you know, even maybe the organizations that you think are not so hot, like if we all stand for each other and our role to be here, then it's way harder for people to push back on us.
All right, so we've concluded that the NDIS is going to an awkward puberty stage at the moment, and we'll see how that goes. Hi, I'm Dr. George Tomopoulos, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, make sure you subscribe to the channel and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In this special live episode of Reasonable and Necessary, we unpack the major changes following the ALP's landslide election victory. What does this mean for the disability community, and how can we work together to build a more effective NDIS? This is our first ever live podcast with a live audience hosted in partnership with People with Disability Australia. Check it out. Thank you to PWDA for having me along to host this important event. I'm very excited. This is going to be my first live podcast for Reasonable and Necessary. And I'm also very, very excited to do a verbal description of myself. I am a man with a physical disability. I live in a wheelchair and I'm wearing a black baseball cap. And can I just say what an awesome panel we have today. I am going to ask each of our panelists to introduce themselves with a visual description. So I'll start with you, Elle.
Hey everyone, hi Dr. George and Trinity, and thanks everyone for having me here today. I'm coming to you from unceded Wiradjuri country, also known as Central West New South Wales. My name's Elle and I am CEO of DANA, the Disability Advocacy Network Australia, and the co-chair of the NDIS Reform Advisory Committee. I am a middle-aged white person with long hair tied back and wearing a red jumper and a blue shirt and glasses. Back to you, George.
Thank you, Anna.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, George, and thanks for the folks at PWDA for having me here today. I am Anna Burke, the Policy and Government Relations Manager at the Summer Foundation, and as a short visual description of me, I have short, probably greying hair, it's fair to say, white to now blushing red skin, and some purple glasses with and blue eyes and a flowery shirt.
Thank you, Trinity, for joining the panel. Great to have you as well.
My name is Trinity Ford. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm the president of People with Disability Australia, or PWDA for short. As a quick visual description of me, I'm a petite, fair-skinned woman with copper red hair, wearing maroon polka dot glasses and my dainty gold fob necklace.
Thank you, Trinity. Let's get started. We have a very different parliament since the election. I'd like us to hear from you, Trinity. How would you describe the current political landscape, and what does it mean for the disability community?
So I suppose we're coming out of this election into a parliament with a very different makeup to how it was before, and different to what we were expecting from the polling and everything going into it. So the thumping that the voters gave the coalition translated into an increased Labour majority. Most of the Teals have retained their seats, but there aren't so many new ones joining. The Greens in the lower house are down to just one seat there, but in the Senate, it's a bit of a different picture. The Greens now have enough seats to control the entire crossbench. So when Labour wants to pass legislation, say on the NDIS or foundational supports, they can pick whether to go a more progressive end with the Greens or to take a more conservative approach by joining with the coalition to get enough numbers to pass the legislation. So that'll be really interesting to watch. And I mean, it narrows the field of parties that we might need to lobby and advocate to ensure that we can protect our members and get the best reforms for us. And speaking of the coalition, this morning they decided to get back together. The trial separation made them realize that they still love each other or that they can't afford to split the house or whatever. Pick your metaphor. So yeah, that's the playing field for the DROs and the disability community over the next 3 years. And we've also got our second disabled federal politician in Ali France, who unseated Peter Dutton. So she's the first disabled woman in parliament by any metric, as far as someone who's out as disabled at least. And it's the first time we've had two disabled federal politicians outwardly identified since about the Second World War wounded era. So that's really interesting seeing a more diverse parliament. We also have a shiny new ministry that we're all getting acquainted with. Amanda Rishworth, the former minister, has moved out to the employment portfolios and looks like she's taking Disability Employment Services and Australian Disability Enterprises with her. Tanya Plibersek is now the Minister for Social Services. She used to have climate and was quite high profile as Education Minister before that, and I think is known as a fairly kind of decent, compassionate person. And then Senator Jenny McAllister is the new substantive NDIS minister. And she's known as something of a long-standing disability ally and has worked in this portfolio before. Technically, Jenny sits under Mark Butler MP, who is the new head of the Department of Health, Ageing and Disability. And I think Anna is going to speak in more detail to what that restructure looks like and what it might look like for us. But I suppose what all of that, those movements tell us is that we've got two ministers who'll be, of the ones who are speaking more directly to the community, they're ones who could be quite well placed to build trust and relationships. They've been fairly good on the rhetoric side of things, saying real commitments to co-design and such. So I'm cautiously hopeful because that's half of co-design, but the other half is actually doing the work. And I know a lot of you and me included are quite nervous about this transition and reform. It's high stakes. And, you know, we haven't seen that other half of the progress and the actual work of this new government yet. We've seen some surprising and concerning changes rolled out. There are still some big question marks over the rollout of NDIS funding periods and the delay of foundational supports and how we'll make sure that people with disability are safe through this period. I don't think that those legitimate questions have been answered satisfactorily enough. So part of all of this change and confusion, I want to be kind of fair to the government, is because of these changes and the reshuffling cabinet and the machinery of government, they need some time to find their feet, I'm sure. I'm really hoping that the government I mean, we'll not fumble this precious moment of hope-based goodwill that exists in the disability community. That, I mean, we've been burned a lot of times in the past, and it's quite hard to rebuild trust and create a space for co-design when people feel like they've been left behind. So I'm really hoping that the government makes good on their promises to come to the table. And that's what we're going to be really focused on at PWDA, in being available to help smooth this transition, educate politicians where we need to, where they'd like us to assist, and then, yeah, be here to help with co-design.
Thanks so much, Trinity. I want to come to you, Al. You have a lot of experience in working with the government. What advice do you have to disability advocates who are watching and thinking, how do we navigate this new world?
Look, in terms of this government, I think Labor has a very large majority, as Trinity said, and that will be interesting for us to work with in terms of, you know, who's going to, we won't have as lively as an opposition as potentially we had in the last parliament. The new ministers are also all from the left faction, which really matters in terms of how to engage with ministers. I do think it's going to be interesting with the NDIS moving to health, ageing and disability. I have mixed feelings about it. I think that there are some positives about the NDIS moving into a universal services type department, so similar to health services and ageing. They're not seen as welfare as such, and so that has some benefits in terms of potentially how it's seen by the wider government, rather than that often conversation that we hear about disability services and supports and policy all being a burden as such. I do think that it's good having a senior minister responsible for the conversations and about foundational supports, settling their deals with states and territories around that. That is going to be so incredibly important. When the NDIS review came out at the end of 2023, we were all really pleased to see finally that foundational support, so what used to be called Tier 2, was on the agenda finally, and that we had this National Cabinet Agreement. But we haven't been able to see any detail of that. Like, we don't know what it looks like. There's been no money. So it's really important to have the states and territories agreeing to those services. So having a very senior person involved in that is a good sign. But it's a lot of change and a lot of new people to get across a really complicated area. So I am sure they're all working hard on getting briefs, but disabled people and our communities need them to get across all of this stuff incredibly quickly.
Thanks, Al. I agree 100% with that. And I'm going to bring you in. The move to disability has been part of health and disability and aged care has been controversial. What's your take on that? And what do you think it will mean for people with disabilities?
Yeah, thanks, George. I think if I reflect on sort of the demeanour of our two new ministers at the moment, I think we've got two very experienced, very keen politicians who are very, very keen to work with the disability community. We've got Minister McAllister, who just last week, I believe, in a speech, reaffirmed the commitment to co-design. So Trinity talked about, you know, needing to see that come through in action. And I think you're right that we need to see what the new government will do in that regard. But I do think that the move in departments shows an intent by government to progress what they call the modern care economy, if you like. So it is bringing together the social services. And what it enables a senior minister like Minister Butler to do is have a look across the service sector and look at some of the common issues and common problems and try and work constructively with the states and territories to solve those. And for example, what Minister Butler has said recently is that foundational support, in his perspective, are very closely tied to the work with states and territories on agreement around health. And he has all of these things in his portfolio. He's a very senior minister, and so he gets the opportunity to work very closely with states and try and bring those things together. What this means for our community is that, hopefully, what we will see over time is what Minister McAllister talked about last week around people not being diverted from systems unnecessarily, inappropriately, but having their needs met where they should be met and seeing stronger relationships between services in local communities. But also, really importantly, having an approach to foundational support that makes sense. And so it gives us a real opportunity with a senior minister who's committed, and then with Minister McAllister, who has also reaffirmed the commitment to co-design to work closely with government and make sure that happens. Now, I know in community, people are perhaps concerned that the move to a department called Health, Disability and Aged Care might take us back to the bad old days of the medicalisation of disability. We don't want to see that. And so, if I'm to say anything to community, it's about, how do we work constructively with the government, with the new department, to make sure that the rights-based approach that everyone has fought so hard for continues? And that includes things like co-design around, what does the new world look like in terms of foundational support and other things that make the connection with other service systems better? What does it look like, and how do we do that most constructively? And I think the other thing I would also say is sometimes these changes in government, what our government likes to call machinery of government changes, can take quite a long time, and can be quite unsettling. So there will be a period of understanding who's doing what role, how do we then make the relationship with the senior public servants and all the public servants that we need to work with, and go forward as best we can, because ultimately we're all trying to do the same thing, and that is to make sure that people with disability can live in community with the support they need.
Absolutely, that's the goal, isn't it? Oh, I'm really interested. You would be probably the person in the room that has the most of the conversations with the powerful people. What do you think will be the priorities of the new government, and what do you think needs attention?
I'm not sure that I do that, George, but I'm certainly happy to speculate. I think there's a couple of conversations. So there is a conversation at the Treasury level about the NDIS that is not helpful, that is not true, and is not helpful. But it does dominate a lot of the internal government conversations. So things about the NDIS not being sustainable, as the rhetoric goes, do influence an enormous amount of behind the scenes activity in government. That's not a secret, and that's also not something that this government invented. This has been going on for a long time behind the scenes. Treasury doesn't like any social spending or public services, so it's not necessarily unique to us, but it is very influential across government. And in the agency, I think responding to that is part of their thinking. It doesn't have to be ours, but I think it is something that we all need to be aware of and understand that that's part of what they are thinking about in Treasury, etc., and are talking about with government. But I think that, a Labor government is interested in, good quality public services, and the Prime Minister said very clearly in the election campaign that they were not going to leave anyone behind. And I'm going to take him at his word that includes us, includes our community, and includes that changes can't leave any of us behind. So I think it's really, really important to, for us to hold them to account, that that means us, and that we get to have a say about what is going to happen and not Treasury, if that makes sense. So I'm not sure how many powerful rooms I do talk in, but it is my job in as part of the RAC, the Reform Advisory Committee with Doogie Hird, is to share with ministers at the Disability Reform Ministers Council the views of the community and the wide and deep views around what is happening, particularly how fast things are happening, the lack of clarity around, you know, when things are happening, things getting sprung on people, all of those kind of things are definitely part of what I'm talking about with people. Anyone who knows me knows that, as I've said in a lot of different contexts, including to you, George, a few times, you know, I'm one of the least diplomatic people that anyone knows. So I'm certainly doing that in every context. You can't imagine that I'm pulling my punches in any meeting that we go to. So I am exactly the same person that I've always been, just possibly slightly less public these days. But I think it's really important that we have disabled people, you know, in a lot of these rooms talking about what's happening to community. I mean, I hear from advocates every single day what the impact of NDIS changes are, and, you know, spend time on the phone with advocates who are working with people with disability and their families to overturn terrible decisions, not just of the NDIS, but of a whole lot of other areas, you know, across our communities that aren't working at all well for disabled people and don't include us at all. So, and it's certainly something I've experienced myself through most of my life. So it's not something that I'm going in there going, everything's awesome. Like, what a great job everyone's doing. So, but I'm keen to think about ways that we can make sure those of us who are not sitting around this table, for example, like, how do we hear all of the different voices that are really important?
Yeah, it's Trendy speaking, if I can jump in as well. I think it's also about just all the different levers that we can pull and making sure that we kind of keep abreast of them.
Got some questions coming from the chat. One of the questions wants to know, when will we see more people with disabilities in Parliament, and what's it going to take to make that happen? Anyone want to respond to that?
I'm happy to quickly. It's Trinity speaking. I think that for proper representation, we need to see the party mechanisms start to take disability expertise and representation seriously in terms of things like pre-selection. So the coalition still need to have a bit of a look at themselves about quotas for women, kind of talking about things like this for disability as well, and making sure that, yeah, people with disability are pre-selected for seats that they can win.
Absolutely. It's really important that we see more people with disability represented in the Parliament. Thank you, Emily, for that question. I want to now go to you, Anna, and ask you about the really important our findings of the Disability Law Commission. It said that people with disabilities should not be forced into group homes, but we've heard very little from the government about what they're going to do to address this problem. What action do you think we need to see from the government so that people with disabilities have better options when it comes to their housing?
Thank you, George. It's Anna here. I think there are a few layers to this answer for me. The first thing to say is, you know, we are still waiting for some substantive action from government on quite a few of the recommendations from the Disability Royal Commission, one of them being around the group home recommendation. At the Summer Foundation, we're really focused on trying to grow better housing and support options for people with high support needs. And we do believe that government needs to do more to stop the flow of people with disability into group homes. And that requires some real energy and thought, you know, and some real kind of effort. And we've been looking into something that is called individualized living arrangements. These are ways of living that people with disability have been doing here in Australia for many, many decades. And this is about people with disabilities sharing their lives with someone who lives with them and supports them. So there's some really strong examples across the country where a person with disability is choosing to live with someone else in their home and they're providing some support, or like in a flatmate arrangement where the person with disability is living in their own home. And what we see from these type of arrangements is that people with disability are having more of a sense of belonging, independence and control over their lives. In some work that we are about to release in a report called Moving Out and Moving On, we look at this question about how can individualised living arrangements be part of the picture of having more options for people with disability outside of group homes, so that government can say, hey, your first option doesn't have to be a group home. You know, you have different ways of being able to choose who you live with, where you live, and how your supports are provided. And we really want to see some more action on that front, because we believe this is one way of living where people are getting better outcomes than in a group home, and it's also more affordable for government. But as well as providing more options in how people live, we think that government also needs to put more effort into what are different ways that people can get support as well, so that this idea that having in-person support is always required can be looked at, you know, because sometimes people could choose to have drop-in or on-call support that might actually suit their needs. And how can somebody say, actually, I'd like my support provided like this, and that is enabled through their NDIS plan. So we think there needs to be a whole range of options, and that we also think that to enable those options, we need to make sure that things like the NDIS support aren't prescriptive. You know, very prescriptive ins and out lists don't help in terms of trying to make sure people have more choice in how they live and who they live with and how their supports are provided. We also think that all governments, that's federal, state and territory, need to do more in terms of the general housing stock for people with disability. There is just not enough accessible housing across the country for all people with disability to choose where they live and in what type of house that they live. And that you know, that is another thing that Minister Butler could be talking to the states and territories about in terms of having a look at, you know, how does this work for all people with disability? And when people have more choice about the available housing stock across the country, then again, group homes won't be the default option. And we really think a broader focus on this needs to occur so that people with disability can choose how they live and who they live with.
Yeah, that was the promise of the NDIS.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it's important that we remember that. I'm really glad that you mentioned the in and out list. It's one of my favourite topics. I hope we don't get the panel's view on these lists. Elle, what do you think? There's going to be a review of these lists. Do you think we can get them fixed so that they work for our community?
Oh, I think we have to. Like, I think as Anna has outlined, there are hard lines around what's in and out. I don't know about you, but I don't live my life in a box. I don't know about anyone else who does. So the ins and outs are causing enormous harm already. And we know that since they came in at the end of last year, or the later part of last year, like, advocates are hearing all the time around people with disability who are ending up with debts for things that were okay before October and now are not okay, but they still need the same things. People who are getting really conflicting advice. So a plan manager and a support coordinator saying different things, the NDIA saying different stuff on the phone. So they go ahead and spend money, which, you know, lots of disabled people rely on the disability support pension, spend money on things, and then find they can't get their NDIS plans back. So it's causing a huge amount of harm and consequences. I also think it's a really expensive way for the NDIA to try and get the kind of boundaries between different parts of government, that's why they're trying to do it. So I think that stuff about this is health over here and that's disability here, those boundaries are all pretty blurry. So the idea that it's easy to kind of chop stuff in the middle is ridiculous. So, and I think where the harder they try and do the boundaries about what is a disability related support and what isn't, the more expensive things are going to get, because it means that people can't, you know, buy stuff at Bunnings or Aldi in the special, you know, middle aisle where things are on special, rather than actually using a specific disability supplier. And I'm already hearing people, you know, who need consumables, for example, being restricted about which providers they can actually buy from. And the things that Anna is talking about, which is so incredibly important, about people being able to have flexible funding to be able to move out of potentially a group home with all of the support that it will need for people to be able to do that, and to be able to have support and flexible living arrangements, there isn't room about that. One of the things that that Dana cares about a lot, we do a fair bit of work around, is climate change. And one of the things that we're really worried about is that for disabled people to be able to get ready for a disaster, and particularly for people who rely on electricity for different reasons, they're not going to be able to use generators or batteries. For people who need heat and temperature control, like I'm one of those people, I can't control my own body temperature, so rely on, power and stuff to do that for me. But for people who need the NDIS to pay for that, they're not going to be able to do that. We know that heat kills disabled people. So I think it's not future-proof and it is not sustainable. It might be easy for a bureaucrat, but for disabled people, it's not going to be sustainable. But in terms of getting it changed, I think it's going to be hard. Like, I think we're going to have to fight hard to get it changed and to be really clear about what the reasons are, and to really fight back against that narrative around misuse of funds, that there is just stuff everywhere around about at the moment. The problems in the NDIS in terms of the cost of the NDIS are with providers, and they're with, you know, the unscrupulous providers that I hear about every single day that are going to target disabled people and are misusing funds, that are taking funds and not delivering services, etc. But then we see, you know, ads around, please don't use your NDIS funds for your garden. You know, sorry, you can hear my grumpiness. I did promise you directness.
It's Trinity speaking. Can I jump in just quickly? I think it's why it's so important that we get co-design right in the first place. It's so much harder to claw something back and retrospectively fix it than just get it right. Like, we've got the expertise and the knowledge to be able to get the rollout right in the first place.
Well, you're right. And I'm thinking now, this really current issue at the moment are the funding intervals. And I'm keen to get your take on that, Trinity, because our community has been very taken by surprise by this. What's PWDA going to do to address that?
Yeah, we're really looking to collect more information. It's a shame that Megan, our deputy CEO, isn't here, because they'd be able to speak about it in much more detail than I can. So we might be able to follow up with a bit more information after. I might defer to Megan, if that's all right.
Fine.
Yeah, I have already written a very grumpy, I feel like I'm just like, here's my grumpy things that I've done this week. So one of the grumpy things I've done this week is to write to the CEO of the NDIA on behalf of the DANA membership. I can see a couple of the DANA members here. But basically, the communications about funding periods said that they had consulted with DRCO as a disability representative and carers organisations, of which DANA is one, but also that there'd been sort of That we were all implied that we were all okay about it, which was absolutely not the case at all. And so I really wanted to make sure that that communication was changed, and it wasn't the agency said that. I think that, the DROs said the opposite. Let's don't do this. And there is a very big forum tomorrow and on Friday, 2 days where disability representative organisations will come together with the agency to talk about a range of things. You can be absolutely bloody sure this is going to get a very large airing from all of us, because there's a really, people are pretty annoyed, to be an understatement. I'm trying not to swear, but yeah, people are annoyed about this because it is unfair and it isn't going to work for lots of people, and it is going to, it doesn't have a lot of room for the, the our lives. Like, disabled people's lives don't always work in this way. I was talking with people about, sometimes things go wrong and you need more support in a particular time, or you need different kinds of support, or you don't always have time to go and do a change of circumstances or to ring the agency or to do anything. And the whole promise of flexible funding was that it was to be adaptive and to support people with disability, to build capacity to manage that funding. It feels very punitive at the moment, where it's like, we're going to manage, the costs of the NDIS by managing people with disability. So it is the opposite of what all of us fought for. I can see Anna wanting to dive in.
I am, because I want to add a little bit of hope if I can. And it's potentially a Pollyanna, but firstly I want to recognize, the incredible period of change and the impact that this is having on community right now. If I reflect on what's happening, from a government perspective, sort of what I can see is, this sort of, it's like an awkward adolescent change from an approach of, we're going to tell you which supports you can have line by line, to the idea of being able to have a budget where you know what you have, and you can spend within that budget. Now, that is still some time away, and so what we're seeing is a tightening of the screws, so to speak, where the NDIA can currently tighten them, which is by being very restrictive for things like funding periods when we didn't have that before. My hope is that if we are able to all work together with government, and design, a budget and assessment model where everybody has confidence in the output of that, so that then we have our budgets and we can spend within that, then the level of control stops there. That's the intent of the legislation change that happened last year, is that, the decision making stops at the budget level, and then you spend, according to your disability support needs. The issue we have right now is that there is sometimes extreme, tightening in areas where there wasn't before, and that's the issue that's causing harm, and so I just hope that the vision can come through and we can all work together and make that happen.
I'm just going to say yes to all of that, Anna. And I do think that if we go back to the NDIS review, and I know there was some criticism around that, but as someone who, we did some of the consultations with folks coming out of prison, group homes, people who are missing out so much on, the real basics and any flexibility at all in terms of services and supports, that there was a vision in the NDIS review to make the NDIS work better for all of us, both inside the scheme and out. And, this is the hard bit. And I look, Anna, you're right, and that was a very useful intervention. I can get very focused on what's happening right now, and I think the bigger picture, if we can stick with it and if we can work with the agency does have a huge amount of potential to be a better scheme, particularly if all of the other elements of it happen. But this is the hard part. I said it in another context. Could we possibly be having a single term of government where we're not having a review into the NDIS? I feel like for those of us who've been around for a while, every term of government, we have another review. Possibly we're now in the really hard doing bit, like the doing of the fixing bit. And for those who were around in the early days of the NDIS, you remember a lot of it was really hard and really weird, and things went wrong and didn't work. So what I'm really fighting hard for is that the disability community remains at the table and in having a say and, you know, being part of that effort to make things better. It's not always going to work. I know in the comments there's lots of things around support needs assessments, and Anna and I both have thoughts about that, which I'm happy to talk about. But also, there is a big wide world outside the NDIS as well. And I think it's really worth us thinking about how we can engage for all disabled people around foundational supports, around navigators. They are reviewing all of the advocacy program as well. You know, so it is, there's a lot of change happening. And I think it would be trying to think about it all together is also helpful to do. I am also, you know, for all of the changes and things that are hard, there are good things happening as well. We have seats at the table that we have never had before, and we are, I can absolutely assure people that things are extraordinarily robust in terms of how your representative organisations are representing people with disability, families, carers, and community. It is not an easy environment for officials to come into, and yet they do, and they sit and they listen. And sometimes we do get change, and they do change things. So we are getting there. It is sometimes the work of implementation is a bit boring and a bit kind of, you know, two steps forward and one steps back. But yeah, thank you, Anna, for the reminding me of there being a slightly bigger picture.
All right, so we've concluded that the NDIS is going to an awkward puberty stage at the moment, and we'll see how that goes. I want to take a question from the audience, and that relates to concerns around impairment notices and how people are going to be categorised as having a particular impairment. Do you think, Elle, I'll ask you, do you think that these impairment notices are going to be sorted out quickly so that people aren't put at risk of having debts if they are incorrectly categorised in terms of the nature of their disability?
Yeah. So the impairment notice was something that, as part of all of the shenanigans around the legislation last year, PIAC, the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, had argued for a long time that it was really unfair that the agency never told anybody why they were eligible for the scheme. You're either in or out, but they didn't ever say what part of your disability or which disability or all the disabilities or, you know, how you were eligible. And so it was all a bit of a mystery which supports went for what, etc. So the impairment notices were put in as part of that. How the agency is implementing them is another story. But I do think there will be reviews available if they get them wrong. They are going to be a different way of people understanding that. It's not going to be the old primary disability, secondary disability framework, which is a good thing. And for people who have complicated, complex disability, but it will be a better description of the different elements of disability that you need support for. How it will be implemented is always the hard question, but it is, as Anna said, part of that bigger stage reform that we've been asking them for a while to be much clearer about the pathway and what's coming. I do think that though for those folks who have, you know, unusual diagnosis or complicated diagnosis, you know, we've talked, I've heard from people in the deaf-blind community, for example, that getting, you know, having a primary disability of being deaf is not terribly helpful if you're deaf blind and missing out on supports, etc. So this is about a way of trying to have the different ways that you need support for categorised and clear and transparent, so that you and the agency have the same picture around that. So again, how it will be implemented by the agency, this is the goal of it, will be interesting. I'm not sure in terms of debts how it necessarily applies to the impairment categories. I'll have to get take you on notice of that, George, in terms of investigations.
Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you.
And I think to the deafblindness, I think that has now been fixed so that deafblindness can be as a primary disability. And it took them a lot of advocacy to get to that point. And that's the kind of stuff we want to avoid for impairment notices. Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to get the panel's view on what it's going to take for the disability advocacy sector to really get some good outcomes with this new parliament and with our new government. What does a strong, united, and disability-led advocacy sector look like, and how and who are going to be our key allies in that work? Can I ask you, Trinity, and then I'll ask the other members of the panel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as DROs, we hold a really unique and important mandate to be able to elevate the voices of our members and the lived experience of people with disability more generally. But to do that effectively, we really need to be able to speak clearly and consistently and in important areas from one voice. I think we've seen this a lot over the last few years. Governments are a lot more likely to fragment, to sideline us when they can see that we're fragmented. So a strong, united voice makes our advocacy harder to ignore, and it's harder to push back or divide or dilute our influence. So, you know, unity doesn't mean that we always have to have the same priorities. There'll always be reasonable disagreement within our space. And that's strong. That's actually what we're here to do. That's the contest of our ideas that we can respectfully argue among. But then I think that we really need to come together on core principles: our rights and inclusion, transparency, what meaningful engagement looks like. And I think the other really central principle is that I think that we all need to have each other's back on the fact that on our right to be here and do this work as DROs. That has to be a not negotiable. So if we don't allow for fracturing or sidelining of anyone, then, you know, even maybe the organizations that you think are not so hot, like if we all stand for each other and our role to be here, then it's way harder for people to push back on us. Like, that's a lesson that I've learned in trans community, which, you know, can be a clicky place like any other community. And just like with disabled community, like, we're under attack from various places. So the phrase for this in my circles is showing up for community also means showing up for that bitch you hate, excuse my swearing. So, like, it's not because you like her personally, it's because you respect her, like, place in this community, and you won't let anybody attack our community, even that be I hate. So that's my little take.
Love it. Thank you, Trinity. Emma?
Look, I think it's hard to top Trinity, but I think it's right that it is easier to work constructively with government if the sector is united, you know, united at the core level. You can have, you know, slightly different takes, as Trinity said, but if we have, you know, a set of core things that we want to achieve and set about doing that, with each of us contributing to the best of our skills and knowledge, then, you know, that makes everybody's job easier and progress more likely to happen. So vote one for the unity and kind of solidarity perspective from my side.
Well.
Oh, look, absolutely agree with Trinity and Anna. I popped a link in the chat to a website put together by the US organization ADAPT, disability rights organization, that talks about the pitchfork method, which I do like jabbing government, to get things done. And they talk about the different parts of the pitchfork, and sometimes the activist part is going, sometimes the legal part, sometimes it's media and communication, sometimes it's the inside track folks, the advocacy organisation, sometimes it's our sneaky allies in the public service and in politics. We are all need to be pointing our pitchforks at the right place, and absolutely, we don't always need to agree with each other. But I think poking our pitchforks at the actual place that can make the change is incredibly important. And having respect for the disabled people who are doing different kinds of work in different places. I've been an activist, as many of you know, at different times, including in the independent assessments fight, when I worked at PWDA and before. And these at the moment, I am a very much an inside track person and doing the work in this way. Lots of us are doing lots of different kinds of work in lots of different places, all in service of our communities. And I think it is really important to know that all of that work matters. All of it is going towards that goal that Trinity talked about us being equal, us being included, us being free. And for those of us who are the least likely to be at the table, for them to have the kind of life that me as a disabled person also have. So, yeah.
Thanks, Alan.
What a great message to end on. I want to thank our panel members. Thank you so much, Trudy, Anna, and Al. And thank you to PWDA for having me as a guest in three of this forum, and that we can feature this on our next episode of Reasonable Necessary. That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts or questions in the comments section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.